Well, beloved listeners, you might recall that last week I was chatting to Ian Crawford. Ian's a professor of planetary science and astrobiology at the University of London. Big fan of the moon, wants to see the establishment of a moon village as a sort of trampoline for the exploration of the solar system. Tonight, we're heading a bit further afield. By the end of this segment, we will be travelling at almost the speed of light in a whopping spacecraft driven by the inexhaustible energy of nuclear fusion, not that dirty old fission. Anyway, all of this will be revealed very shortly by my guest, Peter Riggs. Peter is a visiting fellow at the Department of Quantum Science at the ANU, and he is very much into the possibilities of interstellar travel. How far away is this in our future? What kind of obstacles do we need to overcome? And what do we hope to find out there? Peter, welcome to our little wireless program.
Oh, good evening, Philip. I'm glad to be with you tonight.
At the moment, oodles of money and resources going into the exploration of our own solar system. What might we expect to find outside it?
Oh, I think there's a wealth of information to be found elsewhere in the galaxy. The solar system, we've been getting a pretty good look at it over the last couple of decades. You know, we've got the rovers on Mars, we've had probes to Venus, we've had the very interesting probes go to the outer planets and to Pluto recently.
And of course we had the Hubble ceasing to be myopic and staring deeper and deeper into space.
Indeed, and showing us some of the glories of the universe about us.
And of course, it was funny the other night with Crawford, because when I suggested to him it was an absolute monty that there'd be intelligent life out there, given the vastness of the universe and the infinite number of potential planets, he poo-pooed that. He thought it was quite likely that we were absolutely on our own. That's not a view you would share, is it?
No, I think given the amount of information we've collected about the universe in recent decades, the chances of life elsewhere in the universe are extremely high. If you look at the data from the Kepler Space Telescope, for instance, it looks like just about every star has a planetary system with multiple planets, and about a quarter of the planets in any given system are possibly Earth-like.
So they're in this that sort of sweet spot.
The Goldilocks zone, as they call it. You know, not too hot, not too cold, liquid water, and the basic elements for life.
Give us a sense of the scale involved to get out of our galaxy. Where's the current technology at?
Well, our current technology can only get probes to the other planets in our solar system. As far as getting people are concerned, we might be able to get to Mars within 20 years, but, that's a bit of a stretch. It really depends how much money people are prepared to put into that sort of research and development.
I learned from you that the fastest moving spacecraft thus far is NASA's New Horizons probe, and if that had been aimed to get to the star closest to the Sun, that's Proxima Centauri at 40 trillion kilometres from Earth, it would take 78,000 years to get there.
That's correct. The probes that we launched are restricted in their speed by basically rocket propulsion. And the rocket propulsion has a fundamental limitation on the speed of the exhaust out of the rocket. With rockets, it's pretty slow. You're looking at 10 kilometres a second perhaps, if you're lucky.
Absolutely hopeless. Yeah. Now, let's tire kick you and I in this extraordinary yard I'm in now. Let's tire kick some of the possible technologies. Tell us about the choice, the variety that are on display.
Well, if we want to leave the solar system, then you have to say, are we going to use established technologies? Well, they don't work as such for that. We need to take a step beyond that. For probes, we might be able to use what's called a light sail. And that's very much like a wind sail, but it's driven by the solar wind, that's light from the sun. Energetic photons, that they carry momentum and they can hit one of these solar sails and project them up to a fairly large fraction of the speed of light. And that is actually proposed in a project for the next 20 years called Project Starshot, to send probes to our nearest stellar system, the Alpha Centauri system. It's a really exciting proposal, actually, because this would allow us eventually to get not only photographs but various bits of data on that system, which has recently been thought to have an Earth-like planet.
It's a delicious irony that we're talking about a sail, which of course was the same technology that was used by the brave explorers like Captain Cook.
Indeed, and Magellan and many of the other famous characters from history that went around the world in sailing ships and just through the power of the wind. So now we have the idea of the solar wind doing much the same thing.
What about the ion drive?
Right, well, if we want to send people to other planets, then the solar sail won't do. We would need a propulsion system where the exhaust has a velocity fairly close to the speed of light. And the only thing that we can think of that will do that is ions. Ions are charged atoms. And because they're charged, we can manipulate them. We can make them into a stream and blast them out the back of a spaceship.
Now, I've got one parked over here. It's pretty big and it's got this huge scoop at the front. What's the scoop for?
Well, the scoop is to collect the atoms to use to make into ions and fire out the back. The problem with conventional spacecraft is they've got to carry their fuel with them. And you would never be able to carry enough fuel even to go to the nearest star with people on board. It's just you'd have a spaceship bigger than the solar system.
So, in effect, this is a huge vacuum cleaner.
That's an interesting way of putting it. I'd prefer to say it's more like the aerodynamic ramjet.
I like my vacuum cleaner, but that's not a haggle. So it would suck in these little ions and that would, you know, it gains its power by moving forward, sucks them in and can keep going fast. How fast?
Well, that's a good question. That would depend a lot on the design, but to have effective travel to the nearest stars, you'd have to be doing better than 99% the speed of light.
Okay, so I was joking before about nuclear fusion, but that's your big hope, isn't it?
Well, it is, because in drawing in the particles, which are basically hydrogen between the stars, there's gaseous hydrogen between the stars, and as the spaceship goes along, the hydrogen gets scooped up, goes through the middle of the spaceship and is forced into a fusion reactor, which turns it into helium. It's the same process that the sun works off. And those are helium ions, which are highly energetic, and you spit them out the back of the spacecraft, and that's your propulsion.
Fusion has proven to be very elusive on Earth. I remember talking to some people who were involved in building the A-bomb, you know, who were involved in the Manhattan Project, and this is 30 years ago, and they were absolutely confident that before they carked it, we'd go from fission to fusion, but we haven't made it.
No, there's been enormous engineering problems. When you think about it, though, what you're trying to do is put the sun into a container. That's what fusion is. So you not only have to hold what's called the plasma, the charged particles, you have to be able to hold them for long enough to get enough energy out of it than you're actually putting in to cause the reaction.
And what you have then is literally infinite power, and it's not dirty.
No, it's very clean and it's highly energetic. It really depends on the number of particles that you can fuse as to how much energy you get out of it.
Sagan was on the program a lifetime ago, and of course he thought spending long periods travelling through outer space would be possible if we had some form of artificial gravity aboard the spacecraft, which we could set to 1G. Explain to the listener why that's important, and is it possible?
Oh, it's certainly possible. We would want to have an environment as similar to Earth as we can get for long-duration spaceflight. Now, we know from astronauts being in the International Space Station and the Mir station before that, that there are terrible health effects from long stays in zero gravity, accelerated osteoporosis, muscle loss and such what. If you can have a form of artificial gravity set more or less to what it is on the Earth, you don't get those problems. You've immediately solved most of the health issues of long spaceflight.
What about the issue of surviving acceleration?
Well, the acceleration is equivalent to being on the surface of the Earth, so you wouldn't notice really any difference. That's the key point. The acceleration gives you the artificial gravity. This is a consequence of Einstein's general relativity, that the effects of acceleration and the effects of gravity are the same. So if you set your acceleration to be 1G, the same as on the Earth's surface for falling objects, then there's no problem with surviving the acceleration. In fact, it's desirable.
Okay, what about staying alive for those light years?
Well, again, it depends how far you're going to travel, and the design of the spaceship would reflect the distance that of the trip that's planned.
Well, look, I don't want to go to outer space at a convenient distance. Where might I be able to get it within my lifetime?
Well, depending on how fast you can get the spaceship too, and this is going to be a fascinating point, Philip, you can get anywhere in the observable universe.
You're pulling me.
No, depending on how fast you can get the spaceship up to. So what you do is you go 99.9999999% the speed of light, and you can get virtually anywhere in the observable universe within your lifetime.
Wow. But of course, while you're doing that, things back home would be changing.
Quite a bit different back home, I'm afraid. And again, this is a consequence of Einstein's relativity. So the time in the spaceship can be relatively short, but the time back home is going to be millennia.
So the Earth has been swallowed up by the sun or been gobbled up by a black hole by then, yeah?
Yeah, there's no point in coming back. You have to find yourself a new home.
It's a one-way trip.
In the extreme distances, that's correct, yeah.
It's still nonetheless pretty exhilarating, and I'm sure there'd be absolutely tons of volunteers putting their hands up. So they'd go to another galaxy. The Earth wouldn't be here anymore, or if it was, it'd be burnt to a crisp. Are we talking technically time travel?
Effectively time travel to the future, yes. But you wouldn't really notice it unless you came back to the Earth. If you were going to another galaxy that, you know, was there when you got there, well, for you, it would only be a few decades in travel.
Now, don't be cross with me, but I want you to explain wormholes. I understood, or it's been suggested, going back to my vacuum cleaner proposition, that if you can get into a wormhole, you could cross incomprehensibly larger distances in the twinkling of an eye.
Well, in theory, that's correct, but we don't actually know if wormholes exist. They're still theoretical objects. And again, they come out of Einstein's relativity, his general relativity, which describes the manipulation of space-time by large masses. So the gravity of the Earth, for instance, is due to the space around the Earth being curved. So a wormhole is that sort of extreme curvature where you can have very distant points in ordinary space connected by a tunnel of curved space. And the tunnel itself is actually relatively short, maybe a kilometre or something.
But you'd say this is a Pandora's box of fascinating problems or conundra. For example, you could go backwards in time.
you can turn the wormhole from just being purely for spatial travel into a time machine where you can go backwards in time, but you need to manipulate the wormhole pretty drastically. You need to move one mouth of the wormhole. You know, the wormhole is a tunnel and it's got a mouth at each end. So you go in one mouth, you come out the other. If you can move one of the mouths at a very high speed by perhaps passing a huge mass nearby and dragging it away, then what you do is you create a time effect again from Einstein's relativity, where the mouths are no longer just at different spaces or come out at different spatial points, they come out at different points in time. So by having done that, you could fly a spaceship in through one mouth, which is in the future, and come out in the past.
I don't know about you, dear listener, but I find Peter Riggs a very daunting guest.
Now, oh, it's fascinating stuff, Philip.
Now, Peter, it's a theoretical tunnel, as you said, but most of the... It's amazing, isn't it, that after all this time, again and again and again, recent experiments have proven Einstein's wildest speculations to be on the money.
He's been absolutely on the money. And even in recent last few years, we've had another confirmation of Einstein's theory in the form of gravitational waves. And this was thought to be impossible as little ago as 20 years because the detection level was so small, so minute, that people thought we'd never be able to measure distances so small. And that's a testimony to advances of our technology around the world and at the ANU, because the ANU was a major partner in the detection of gravitational waves. But yes, it was a major prediction of Einstein's theory made more than 100 years ago.
So you must be, you must be enjoying the fact that there's increasing enthusiasm again after, in a sense, sort of an interregnum. Now everyone's talking space research, space tourism, space mining.
Yes, well, there was certainly a lag after the Americans stopped going to the moon, and the more recent resources that have been deployed into investigations and explorations are showing that the solar system and the universe at large is a fascinating place and something worth exploring.
Peter, the sort of work you're discussing, well, it's so immense and so much of it is counterintuitive, but to be feasible, people like you would have to work with colleagues all over the world, wouldn't you? You'd have to be talking to Russian scientists, to Japanese, to American, certainly to Chinese.
Well, yes, I think people involved with science generally and our advanced technologies are talking a lot more and working in collaboration because the tasks are so enormous that we need international collaboration and we need international resources. No one country can really do this sort of work anymore. And that's a good thing because it brings people together as well as getting resources that you otherwise wouldn't have.
And Carl Sagan would certainly approve of that. Peter, thank you for coming on. Peter is visiting fellow at the Department of Quantum Science at that splendid place, the ANU. And if you're in Canberra, you can hear Peter's talk on interstellar journeys within a human lifetime at the ANU on Thursday night.